Dear Ajahn, how to deal with the problem of tiredness causing low mindfulness in a busy lay life? It's an easy question to answer. Retire. Okay, so how can you keep being productive but actually just don't get so tired? One way of doing that, and I love telling this story, the first book that I wrote, Opening the Door of Your Heart, how that book was written. First of all, I gave many of these stories just live, you know, just speaking them, over in our Armadale group many years ago. And one of the ladies, you know, she had gone through a very difficult time in her life, you know, with a breakup of a relationship. And she said, "They saved my life." She said, "I'd be dead without those stories." I mean, no, she said, sort of committed suicide. "They need to be written in a book to share with others." And of course, my response was, "No, I'm too busy, got too many other things to do." She was really smart. She said, "Well, look, I will write them, and then I'll give them to you to edit." So after a week or two, she gave me this bunch of stories to edit. And they were hopeless. I really think she did it on purpose. Because when I saw this, I said, "Well, instead of editing, I might as well do it myself." So I told her, "Look, I'll do it." So I waited for a little while, and I chose a time when I was on a meditation retreat, a personal retreat. You know, they do one, two, about two weeks over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And I'm very well disciplined. I got the pieces of paper together, and I said, "I'm only going to do 1 hour a day." And that was all. And I was very strict with myself, just 1 hour. I had the clock in front of me, and I wrote out, you know, as many stories as I could remember. And by, I think, 12 or 13 days, I had half the stories already written down. And I still got the manuscript, written manuscript. And my goodness, when I look at that, it's almost perfect. You know, the people ask me, just, you know, "What font did you print that out on?" It's just handwritten. And there's hardly any mistakes. It's just as you wrote it, that's actually what came out. And I've got the original manuscripts up in my room. And I keep it up there because it inspires me. It's just what happens with your meditation. Half that book, just 1 hour a day, just did it, finished it, and then carried on meditating afterwards, a bit of exercise. And I waited for a while and then did the second half of the book, about the same time. It hardly took any time at all to write a book. And anyway, once it was written out by hand, I gave it to one of our members who would type it up for me. And this was quite a long time ago. I typed it on those CD discs. And so once it was typed out, it was a bit slow, but you know, it didn't need any editing. I said, "Look, this is it, just as it is." And anyway, he finally typed it out for me, and it's just, you know, about an hour before I went to Perth Airport to go and give some talks in Melbourne. I never checked it. He just gave it to me, and I put it in my bag. I haven't got my bag here today. But you know my bag, I put things in. That's a good example. Just listening to what I said. The bag I put things in. It's just my yarm. It's like a monk's bag, and it's amazing what you can put in that bag. And sometimes I get, you know, I lose things in there. And where's the keys? Where's that pen? And I realize that's my karma, because I always would tell my mother off. She had her handbag. She could never find anything in it. And that's the trouble. When you criticize your mother, you have to endure what I gave her, and I can't find things in my bag. But anyway, I had that CD in the bag, and when... how easy it was to get published. All I did was to go to Melbourne University was the first talk, off the plane, someone picked me up, took me to the university, sat me down, and I gave the talk straight away, the first talk. And after the talk, this lady came up, and she has a name I will never, ever forget. Her name was... Yeah, I think it was Magnolia Flora or something like that. It was a really weird name. Anyway, she came up to me and she said, "That's a lovely talk. I work in the publishing industry. If you've ever got anything you want published, please let me have a look at it." In my pocket. "Here you are." I gave it to her straight away. And of course, the publishing house liked it and published it. And it was, sold to some other, that publishing house was sold to somebody else and sold to somebody else, and it was translated into many different countries. And that opened the door of your heart. It does very, very well. It's actually still a bestseller in Germany, Der Kuta Weinti. Is there any German speakers here? There you go. Have you seen that book?
Yes, of course. Give it to many friends.
Excellent. Is it still a bestseller?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You find it in every bookshop.
You find it in every bookshop?
Yeah. We have a religious section.
Yeah. It's always there. Yeah, it's still got the Despicable Bestseller sticker on it, usually. Yeah. It's done really, really well. And that was about 14 or 15 years ago when you wrote that. So it's amazing, and that's actually how it was done. It was no tiredness at all, you just wrote it out, 12 hours and another 12 hours. You didn't have to worry about publishing it. Just something, when anything published, let me know, here we go. And it's kind of weird, I'm not exaggerating, but that's actually what happened. So when you are mindful and kind, and you've got some stillness, that's what happened when I was on my meditation retreat. It's so easy to produce, to innovate, produce, and just produce that first book. So quick, so easy. So that you don't get tired, because you know how to not waste time. So whatever you do, you can be extremely productive, you're not tired. The next thing which happens is that when I keep on going on the deep meditations, but I can't help it, because if you have some really good meditation, again, you don't get tired. And you don't just need good meditation when you're on a meditation retreat. Whatever you're doing. How much work have I been doing on this retreat? Giving talks, interviewing you, going over to Bodhinyana Monastery, talking to people over there. There's a whole family today came because their mother and grandmother died recently, unexpectedly. So talking to them. It's amazing just how much work I do. Do I look tired? Sometimes I am. And that's when the meditation doesn't really get going. This retreat's been very nice. So I come up here just before the talk, when I possibly can. And if I get some nice meditation, you're going to get a great talk. And I know why, and that's what it says. Is that Nalakapana Sutta. It says anybody who gets nice deep meditation, that not only the five hindrances disappear, but also weariness and discontent. The weariness. I'm an old monk now. I shouldn't have much energy left. Used it all up. But no, when you get meditation, the weariness of life just disappears. So this is how you can increase your energy even when you go into lay life. It says busy lay life. What does busy mean? One of those books, which are just like quotes from me and cartoons from Kartika over in Indonesia. She's a very good cartoonist. is like, what is actually busy? This guy, a businessman with so many hands, and a mobile phone in one hand, something else in another hand, we're doing so many things at the same time. See, now that is that type of multitasking, that what exhausts you. And you think you'll get more things done that way. It doesn't work that way. You're doing more things at the same time, but you're not doing them well. Often you have to go back and do them over again. It's much better to do one thing at a time, give it everything you've got. You don't even think about what I'm supposed to be doing afterwards, just what you're doing now. And then you find you're efficient, productive. What people want in, if they employ you, they don't care if they may pass. Oh, this example just came to my mind. Years and years ago, some of the builders of this monastery, they were telling me that they were building this really, really fancy house for this rich person over in Sydney. And the rich person said, look, it doesn't matter about cost, I want really high quality. I'll pay more for it. And then the rich person came to inspect the house as it was being built. And there was this young guy, maybe only 18 or 19, doing the brickwork. And the rich person complained, look, I want the very best, not apprentices. And the head builder came, come and have a look. And this young man, he was just so efficient laying the bricks. He didn't look like he was doing it fast, but he was so focused and so skilled, he did it faster than his old bricklayers who'd been doing it for years. And he said, I found him. He said, it's amazing, look at him. And the client, the person who was having this house built for him, said, I never expected that. It was efficiency. He never looked busy, but he got so much done really quickly. I don't know if you've ever seen people like that. Whatever they're doing, they're writing a report or something, and it comes out really quickly. And it's good quality, because their mind is focused. So that's what meditation does. So when you go back to work, please, take, was it half an hour or an hour to meditate at lunchtime, you get more work done. Believe it or not. But you're not on the computer, you're not at the work desk. You're not at the work desk, correct. But your mind is working on all cylinders. And it's amazing how quickly you can do things. And that's what I say, that from personal experience, of writing open the door of your heart. So easy. Anyway, dear Ajahn, how would we use death contemplation for meditation? What that does is realizing, you know, you're not going to last much longer. Look, sometimes you can't believe. Now I'm 72 in a couple of weeks' time. Where did all those years go? I think what happens is that once you start going downhill, what age do you start going downhill? 40? 35? 30? No, that's wishful thinking. I remember with the youth group, with the kids asking, how old is old? And they looked around each other and they said, yeah, about 25 is getting old. But anyway, whatever age you think it is when you start going downhill, once you start going downhill, you start to pick up speed. In other words, you go faster and faster and faster and faster as you near the bottom. But anyway, so one day you're gonna die. You've done it before. This time, do it properly, do it right. It's like, you know, you have all these driving tests, you have these tests at university and school. What happens if you don't pass the test? You have to do it again. That's called reincarnation, rebirth. If you don't pass the test this time, you're going to have to get reborn again. Have a think about it. Get reborn again. You have to start wearing nappies again. You know, you want to, you want something and your mother doesn't understand what you want. You have to go to school again. Do you think you're finished with school now? If you don't die right, you're going to go back to school again. You have to do all these exams and be told off, sent to the principal's office. I don't know, that's all in front of you. You haven't left yet. And then you have to go and get a job. Then you find a partner in life. You never find the right one. It's always, they always promise a lot, but they don't give what they really promise. And then you've got to go and get a job. You've got to do it all over again. Oh, my goodness. Haven't you had enough? So, one of the things about death is this time do it properly. When you die, totally let go. So one of the death contemplations, you can't take it with you. So because you can't take it with you, you might as well. It'd be wonderful if you know exactly when you're going to die. As I said, then you can stagger it all so you know exactly how much to give this year, how much to give next year, how much to... And so by the time you actually die, you'll have absolutely nothing left. It'd be wonderful if you could do that, wouldn't it? Anyway, the death contemplation, again, it also reinforces what I said a couple of nights ago. You're only a visitor to this body. You visit it for, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 years, and then you have to let it go. You can't take it with you, and that's a good job you can't take it with you. If I could take it with me, then in my next life as baby boy, I'd be fat again. So you can let it all go. You don't own anything. That's what death contemplation teaches you. You may have been a brilliant theoretical physicist in your last life. But in the next life, you have to go to school again and learn what goes up, goes down. Simple stuff, have to do it all over again. It must be very, very, very hard. So anyway, because you don't own anything, you have to let everything go. Your intelligence, your wealth, your body. You may train yourself and get a wonderful body, nice and fit and healthy and beautiful. Then you have to let it go. I let my body go many years ago. Anyway, you know, it makes life really easy when you don't sort of own anything, not even your body. I often think that too, that, you know, what's my body made of? Not the food which I buy, it's all the food you put in my body. You own this, not me. If you think I'm fat, it's your fault. What are the excuses? That's my death contemplation. Dear Raj, thank you very much for the kindness that you have taught and shared over the last 9 days. It's not only 8 days yet. We haven't finished yet. Didn't I say stay in the present moment? Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? We may find out tomorrow afternoon or tomorrow morning there's been some strike at the airport and Perth Airport is closed down. What are you going to do? You've got no choice, you have to stay. So the retreat isn't over. There's one of my friends, I knew him many years ago. He actually came through Wat Banana Chart. When it first opened, And then from there he was going off to Korea to join a monastery there to ordain. And he ordained there, and he told me about his first retreat in that monastery in Korea. It's a very strict monastery. They did a 60-day retreat. Not like soft and kind like this place. I always like telling you about this retreat so you will never put any complaints in about Jhana Grove. They would do, they'd start in the morning, 45 minutes meditation, sitting cross-legged, and you couldn't get up and go to the toilet, not because you were sore. 15 minutes, still in the hall, everybody together doing walking meditation. Another 45 minutes sit, another 15 minutes walk, another 45 minutes sit, another 15 minutes walk. When it was the lunchtime, they'd bring the food to you, right in front of you. You couldn't go anywhere. You had the food there. And when you were finished, they took the plates away, and then you carried on meditating, another 45 minutes sit, another 15 minute walk, right throughout the day. If you needed to go to the toilet, that was fine, but you couldn't go so too many times a day. And the only other thing was to go to the interviews. In those days, those Zen monks, not like Ajahn Brahm, not at all, they would ask you how you were going, and if you gave a wrong answer, you got whacked with the Zen stick. It wasn't very fun going to the interviews. Not like these ones over here. Every day, every spot is filled in. Not in that monastery. And then the end of the day, I think 10 o'clock, then okay, that's the last meditation. Then you can go to sleep. Not in any room. You sleep right where you were sitting. I think you'd have a blanket or something, and that's where you... And in the morning, bong! And then you woke up, another 45-minute sit, 15-minute meditation, 45-minute sit, 15-minute walking meditation, right throughout the day. 60 days. Yes. Even only after 7 days, his back was aching, his butt was aching, his knees were on fire, everything was aching. And when he looked and saw all these other meditators, he was from New Zealand. All these other meditators were from Korea. And he looked at them and they were sitting perfectly straight. They didn't look like they had any pain. And that really embarrassed him. He said, I'm a Caucasian, I'm a Kiwi. I'm not going to be outdone by these South Koreans. So he endured. The next 7 days went past, really painful. That's only 2 weeks, had another, so was it 6 weeks to go? Oh my goodness, what I'm going to do. He really fought, and he was really enduring so much pain. And after the 4 week period, halfway. I'd done 4 weeks. Even though he would love to run away, couldn't end the pain, nevertheless, he thought, if I stop now, it'll be unfaithful to all the endurance and hard work I've done so far. So he kept on going. But when you get to halfway, when you start thinking like that, the first half is remembered as being so short, and time tends to slow down. The next week was like forever. But eventually 5 weeks had gone past. And he just, aching, burning all over. When he did go to sleep at night, he laid down, and he was sure just he was only sleeping for 1 second, and then bong, it started all over again. Never enough sleep. And then 6 weeks had gone past, 6 weeks, only 2 weeks to go. Surely he could handle this. But time got longer and longer and longer, the more it was hurting. But then 7 weeks, the last week, only 1 week to go. And that 1 week was like a year. I don't know how he did it, but the final day arrived. He just laid down and bong, he had to get up again, but it was the final day. And in those traditions, when the retreat is finished, they have like hot baths. And he was just drooling over those hot baths. You know, all those aches and pains and stiffness in his body, he could lay in the hot bath. He was imagining it, fantasizing about it. And also they had like a feast afterwards, not just a simple food in front of him. He could go to this big banquet and eat as much as he wanted. And he was thinking of the banquet too. Just to eat leisurely, not just sitting down there, to eat whatever he wanted, take it easy. But that last day, it lasted. That's why they call it a last day, because it lasts much longer. He went on forever. And then, but eventually he did get to the last 45-minute meditation. And he thought, only all that effort he'd done, all of that endurance, only 45 minutes to go, that's nothing. That's what he thought at the beginning of the meditation. But as the meditation continued, he was really struggling with the aches and the pains. So what he decided to do, he just opened one eye to have a look at the clock. That can't be right. That was at least half an hour. Only 2 or 3 minutes. And then he started thinking, what happens if the battery in the clock has got worn out and the clock is actually going slow? It does happen, you know. Even that clock, you know, in the interview area, we had to change that or change the battery because it stopped. Imagine that would happen. The clock stopped. Oh my God, he had all these terrible fantasies. It was torture. And that clock went so slowly. But of course, eventually, the senior monk rang the gong. The retreat is over. He'd made it. He'd done it. It was touch and go for such a long time. He almost like exploded and died because of the agony. But now it was over. Just, you know, 3 bows, and then he could go to the hot baths. Oh, that was just like going to a heaven and have all the food he wanted to eat to relax and celebrate a magnificent achievement of endurance. And they were just about to do the bows. And then the head monk said, excuse me a moment. I just have an announcement to make. He didn't mind that because announcements only take a few minutes, a few seconds. He said, during the interviews, many of you monks have told me how amazing, how wonderful, how beneficial this retreat has been. You've either heard this story before, you know what's coming. So the head monk, I've been contemplating this last night, and I think, you know, it's just so important to get deep meditation, get enlightened, and you're having a very good time here. So on the request of these two monks, I've decided to extend the retreat for another 2 weeks. Cross your legs and carry on meditating. And this monk, he told me, he said he didn't feel any pain. Because his mind was consumed with anger. And with fantasies and thoughts of revenge. He was trying to figure out, he had a good idea who these two monks were. And what he was going to do to them, you know, was not Buddhist at all. They did this to him. That was unacceptable, unforgivable. And then, because of the anger, he didn't feel any pain. But also, the head monk rang the gong. Half an hour had passed by. Just like that, so quickly. Not like when he was meditating, when half an hour was like half a day. And then the head monk said, okay, retreat over. There's hot baths downstairs and a nice feast for you. And this Kiwi monk, he was so confused. What's going on? Is the retreat over or is it going on? And that's when one of the other monks came up to him and said, the head monk does this trick every year. The same trick, pretending the retreat's going to go on even longer when he never does. And this Kiwi monk said, I learned more in that last half hour than from the rest of the whole retreat. Expectations. Expectations. He could manage to... It made it more painful when you expect it, you know, another couple of days to go. And then when you think it's finished, and then you find it's not. That's what expectations do. A source of suffering which is totally unnecessary. So the retreat only finishes in 2 weeks' time. Oh, anyway. Hey, what am I doing? Thank you very much for the kindness that you have taught and shared over the last 9 days. Now that we're all going back to our usual daily life, full of distractions, can we seek your advice on how we can keep up the daily meditation practice? Very simple. You just sit down, cross your legs, close your eyes, and meditate. That's how you keep it up, by doing it and seeing its value. What was this? Seeing its value, that's the amazing thing. There's this one fellow, he would be a deep sea diver and fixing up cables underground. So it was like a 2 week on, 2 week off type of job. But in his house, it was good pay. In his house, he built a new house and he used underneath the stairs, this was many years before Harry Potter, underneath the stairs was where he built his meditation room for him and his wife. So they could go under there and that's where they had a quiet place totally set aside for meditation, nothing else. And they would go in there when they needed to sit down and be peaceful and be still. But then the amazing thing happened, he told me. He had two kids, you know, a young girl and a boy, a little bit older. And they were just playing in the garden one day. And they had an argument. You know how kids tease one another. And the elder kid hit the sister. That was the first time that he ever hit his younger sister. And I think you can understand, and it's only because he was frustrated, you can understand what the little sister felt. She burst into tears, not because of the pain of being hit, but the fact this was from her brother, who she loved. And she didn't know how to handle it. She's only about 3 or 4. You know where she went? She ran into the meditation room underneath the stairs. Even though Mum and Dad had told them, no, you don't go in here, this is for Mum and Dad to meditate. That's where she went and sat down to recover. It was like the kind room, the room of peace, the room where she could feel safe, the room where she could relax. She was never told to do that. That's where she was kind of attracted to. And they told me that story, and what a wonderful thing that is. You have difficulties to go through, little traumas, and you have a place where you can go. So that's why I ask everybody, if you haven't got any stairs, build a flight of stairs. They don't have to go anywhere. And put a meditation room underneath, or a cupboard or something. And that's how you can keep up the meditation when you go back. Have a place set up for it, first of all. So you don't need to find, we're going to go meditate. And have it comfortable. How you like it. If you're cold, and have a heater there. If you're warm, have an aircon or something to cool you, or a fan or something. Have it as quiet as possible. All the cushions which you need. Set it up. People have all these incredible rooms in their house. They don't just have a bedroom and a kitchen and a dining room. They have a family room, a lounge room, a games room, a TV room. I don't know how many rooms, a sauna room. And many of those rooms you hardly spend any time in at all, but they're still there in your house. Just have a meditation room, for goodness sake. A place where you can go any time, day or night, when you feel stressed out and you've had an argument, when you just feel a bit sickly, just to actually unstress your mind. If you have a place there already, it makes it much easier to go there. And, you know, your kids can go there if they want, if they're quiet and meditate. You know, your partner can go there. You know what you find happening? If you have a dog, the dog goes there as well, loves it. I haven't told this story yet. It's okay, if I don't finish all the questions, I can always do them tomorrow. The retreat's not finishing, is it? So anyway, this was a story about this lady. I was in one of the cities in California, and she was doing her shopping. She came back, you know, drove the car, you know, into the driveway, opened the doors, and took all the shopping out and all the bags. She had so much in her hands. She just managed to get the key out for the door and open it and kick the door open. And as she kicked the door open, this dog ran into her house. And she didn't have any free hands to stop the dog running into her house. She had hands full of groceries, so she put the groceries in the kitchen and went looking, what is this dog doing? And she saw the dog had already curled up in the corner of one of the rooms and was sleeping. And she looked at the dog. It was clean. It had a collar around its neck. And it's quite a very well-mannered, beautiful dog. What it was done, curled up, just having a nap. And she liked the dog. Just its look was very nice. It wasn't doing any harm. It was clean. So she let it sleep. And then she unpacked all the groceries, and after an hour or two, she noticed that the dog, you know, got up and had a little bark, a very small bark. And so she opened the door and the dog ran away. She told her husband, this is kind of strange. But anyway, see what happens. The dog came back the next day. So she let the dog in the house. The dog went into the same corner, curled up, went to sleep. After an hour or two, one bark, and then she let it out again, like a visitor. And of course, you know, she liked it. It was only a corner of the room, didn't take up any time, didn't ask for anything, just wanted to have a nap. But then in the end, they wanted to find out what's going on, and the husband had this really good idea to write a little note on a piece of paper, fold it up, and put it under the dog's collar. And the note read something like, we don't know who you are or where you're from, but your dog comes into our house every afternoon at this time and just goes into a corner and has a sleep. We don't know where it's from or why it does this, but we want to let you know that the dog is quite welcome in our house. It's clean, it's well behaved, it just wants a nap, why not? And I put it under the collar. And the next day, the dog came back, had a new note under his collar, had an answer. And they read the answer, they let the dog go and sleep. And the answer was, yes, we live about a block away from your house, not the same street. In our house, we have about 5 or 6 kids. And they always like playing with this dog, never give it any peace. It's a very noisy house. Your dog comes to your place for a bit of peace and quiet, wrote the owner of the dog. And he added, can I come too? That's what some people's houses are like. Just little kids running around, very noisy, teenagers making lots of noise. And so you can imagine these poor dogs. If they had a place to go to, they would go to the meditation room straight away. That's why you find that your dog will go to your meditation so often, its favourite place. Anyway. Okay, I've only done 3 quotes, goodness gracious. My sense of self seems to increase after meditation. Isn't something wrong? Should I continue to practice sitting down meditation? I'll continue to practice sitting down meditation. But if your sense of self seems to increase after meditation, it must mean that when you're doing some jobs, your sense of self must start to decrease. That's logic, isn't it? So do more work. That means after you work, when you go home and you go back to the work, you do a lot of job, your sense of self should be decreasing, shouldn't it? Well, it increases during meditation. It can't keep increasing all day and all week and all year. Otherwise, you'll be like Mr. Trump. Oops. Now, I think that's a perception which probably is not going to be accurate. When you do many weeks of meditation, like you've come here and done a 9-day retreat, I think you will usually find your sense of self diminishes. One thing I would say about this, that you're with everybody else here. And so our senses of self, our peace, our happiness, actually it all decreases together. And then what happens tomorrow when you go out of here? You'd be quite surprised at how busy everybody else is. This was on a 3-month retreat. One of our people on that 3-month retreat, he thought his meditation wasn't getting anywhere. So I used a little trick. I said, please excuse me, but we need some stuff for the storeroom here. Would you mind just going into the supermarket? You can drive. Here's the Jhana Grove's car. Can you go into the supermarket and get these things for me? And I gave him the list. He said, I don't need any money, I'll donate this. So he went into the supermarket. When he came back, he said, I've got all the stuff for you, Ajahn Brahm. It's crazy in there. People are rushing around all over the place. And I said, now you know how much progress you've made in your meditation. You used to live in places like that. A lot of time, the quietness, the peace you develop on a retreat, you don't notice it. Because everybody else is developing at roughly the same rate. When you go back tomorrow, you go to the airport, you go to a station, you go home, you will find just how much you have calmed down. It kind of surprises you. Your ego has got more? No, it ain't. You got more peaceful. Dear Ajahn, thank you for this wonderful retreat. Thank you to initiate it, and thank you for all the donors and support this to come to reality. Also from Christina, Noria, Pat, and Scott, to Gardner, to the ants, to the birds. No, I did those. And all the rain and the cold and the sore knees and the sore butt. To the people who involve to maintain this beautiful place, your kindness and generosity is amazing. May all you gain energy from this peaceful giving, and may you all bless with much merits. Thank you. Signed from Ajahn Brahm. No, I never wrote this. Now, it's nice to have gratitude, but don't just leave it with gratitude. We always have this thing about, and Ajahn Chah taught me this, pay it forward. Whenever I try to thank him for teaching me something, he'd always say, no, don't thank me. You're in debt to me, he said. You owe me. And the only way to pay off that debt is for you to go and teach and help somebody else. In other words, the teachings keep going on and on and on and on. So if I've helped you, just saying thank you is not enough. Just giving $1 million donation is not enough. The only way you can pay off your debts to me is by helping somebody else. You're in trouble now, aren't you? No, you're not in trouble. It's a beautiful thing to be able to do. Dear Ajahn, thank you for giving this wonderful, relaxed retreat experience. Your dedication towards teaching deep, profound Dhamma in a simple way is amazing. I'm sorry about this. Is beautiful. Thank you for your nice comments. You know, once I caught myself, and I'm almost catching myself now, when people praise you, you're afraid of being praised. That's why I was telling a few jokes about it. But then what happened, many years ago, I was awarded this, called it the John Curtin Medal from John Curtin University for community service, leadership, what was the other thing? I think compassion or something. And then this is from a university. And so I had to go along to receive the prize. And I had to give a speech as well. And it's a speech which I think many people give when they receive some sort of prize like that. I said that, thank you very much for giving me this prize. I was right, for three things, community service, vision and leadership. And I, you know, my character. And I said, it can't be for community service, because that's what you do when you're released from jail. You do community service. So it can't be that. It can't be for vision, because I have to wear glasses. So it must be for leadership. And anyhow, and honestly, I said, look, I don't know why you're giving this award to me. And I there's many other people in this, in Perth, who do far greater community service, leadership and help for everybody than I do. And also, I couldn't have done this with all the people who support me, all the other monks, all the lay people, the people who work in the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, the nuns and everybody. You know, it's always a group effort. But anyway, thank you anyway. And then the next year, I went to this other person who was, say, Professor Jofi. He was a head hematologist in one of the big hospitals in... that's right, it was... Yeah, it was, which more hospital was it? It was in Fiona Stanley, I think. It was, no. I think it was Fiona Stanley he was working. It could have been Charlie Gardner's hospital. But he was a head hematologist, you know, dealing with people who had cancers. And that he decided that the hospital wasn't doing enough. They gave first-class treatment according to medical ideas. But then, after treatment, they were just leaving the hospital. And he thought, that's not good enough. So he got a few rooms in St. Charles Gardner, it was Charles Gardner Hospital, in St. Charles Gardner Hospital, got a few rooms, and he started off this alternative therapy centre. There was like a local, it was a dairy, Brown's Dairy, sponsored it. And in this facility, anyone who had any sort of cancer treatment in that hospital could go into those rooms and get free homeopathy, acupuncture, Reiki. And as he said it, anything weird was allowed in there. And some of his associates, you know, the top doctors in the hospital, thought, you've gone crazy. There's no medical basis or research to show this is actually working. And he said, at the very least, every patient who comes out, you know, from the surgery or from the radiation therapy or whatever, they can go into those rooms and somebody will be giving them a foot massage. I don't know if it works, but someone is with them for half an hour or an hour, caring for them. They're giving them Reiki. They're giving them something where there's much more personal contact. And I said, that, apparently, he tried that, he risked his reputation, but he did the research and had far better remission rates than were expected, far better. It was actually working, even though he risked his reputation for that. So that's why he was awarded the John Curtin Medal the year after I was. And when he was saying all of that, I thought, wow, that's someone who risked their reputation to lead and make a real difference in people's lives. So he got up to give his speech, and I was actually quite shocked. Because when he gave his speech, he said, there's other people in the community who do much more work than I do, and I couldn't have done this anyway without the help of all my friends and colleagues and staff. That was my speech! And you hear that so many other people do the same speech every year. And then I started, that guy deserved that medal. And then I started actually thinking, maybe I did too. Because there's some very smart people at Curtin University have to be on the people who look and investigate and decide who deserves these prizes. There's no money involved, just a medal. But nevertheless, and then I realized perhaps I did deserve it. So these days, when you give some praise like this, thank you for giving this wonderful, relaxing retreat experience. Your dedication towards teaching deep, profound Dhamma in a simple way is amazing. Yes, I agree with you. Sometimes it sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? You praise me, and I said, yes, you're right. It's weird, isn't it? It's strange. You're not supposed to do that. They said if you receive praise, you get a big head. That's not right. You don't get a big head. You get a big tummy. You actually get a big heart. When you receive praise like that, you want to do more. You're being honest. Thank you. Thank you for inspiring us by showing practically your simpleness, humbleness, kindness, virtue and compassion. We can't believe how lucky we are to have you around us. Yes, that's true. I'm being consistent, okay? What I say, I do. Thank you for starting these retreats, monasteries, nuns' ordination, etc., so on. Thank you for your courage to go beyond normality. Nationality? Something. Anyway, thank you for your courage to go. Especially thank you for emphasizing us the possibility of achieving jhanas as laypersons. Your cave living inspired us. Are you going to build a cave when you go back home? It's wonderful, you can sell your house and just live in a cave in the back garden. It's much more easy. May you be happy and healthy every day. What about nighttime? May the power of giving and kindness give you more and more universal energy towards a spiritual journey. Much merit to you, Ajahn. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. But the nice part of that story was when somebody praises you, can you receive it? Nauria, you've been an excellent manager. Do you agree? I didn't hear anything. Yes, you are. You accept that? You know how hard and embarrassing it is to accept praise? But then I say that someone's done something wrong. They're, oh, you didn't come to this meeting this morning, or you didn't do this right. We accept that very easily. Oh, yeah, you're right. Oh, you ate too much. Yeah, look at me. Oh. Why is it we can't accept praise, but we can accept blame? If people accepted praise more, they'd become much better people. Anyway, that can't be the time. I can be quicker. I have been prior to I'm trying to do it fast, I can't. I have been prioritizing virtue, generosity and kindness for most of my adult life, yet I can't see any improvement in happiness levels. Instead, I'm getting more melancholic, and being human and therefore partial to happiness, I find myself discouraged to keep going. I trust Buddha's teachings are the reality of life, but this being human is tough without joy. Any advice? That's a great question. Whoever wrote that, you're amazing. I'm praising you. Well done. Can you receive that praise? If you can't, that's why you can't experience joy. Negativity, yes, you receive that. And you keep on receiving too much negativity and keeping that. And you say, oh, they're right, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. Then you get no happiness and joy, you get depressed. And you really do think that being a human being is tough. When people praise you, please accept it. That's where you grow. And that's where you find more joy and happiness in life. In all these, even like the people I met in prisons, some of the people I met there, like burglars, sometimes I say, well done, you're such a skillful burglar. You're one of the best burglars in the whole of Perth. I think I can get a job for you. Just, you know, working in the Secret Service. Of course you can get a career. If you're a really top burglar, you know how to get into... Even knowing how to get into safes. Now, how many people forget the combination or the key doesn't fit or that they made some mistake, they can't get in the safe? People who have been burglars or safe breakers, they can do that for you. It's a great career for them. People who... They do this with hackers, apparently. People who get caught hacking into the CIA or something, and they get offered these amazing jobs to hack into the, was it the, not the KGB anymore, hacking. I shouldn't have gone like this. I'm going to get arrested. But you know what I'm doing. See something positive, whatever you do, it's amazing. I see the sequence of some of the important events in my life as chapters of my own storybook, then write it down. This retreat was another chapter, not just an ordinary chapter, but the one which defines how the story ends, how the stream meets the river. Thanks for co-writing this chapter. Hope we meet again soon. And a guy, scientist, is Mara. But I know that's an anagram for another name. Am I correct? Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, the monks, nuns and retreat supporters for providing us with such a wonderful retreat. Yes, you all deserve that. Something that is troubling me as we reach the end is I feel I lost an opportunity for deeper human connection with the wonderful people here due to the noble silence. Maybe I needed the noble silence to realize this. I did appreciate the not talking. I feel sad missing more eye contact, smiles and gestures. For everyone, if you wanted a reaction from me and never got one, I'm sorry. I wish you all well. It's been a fabulous 9 days. It hasn't finished yet. That's why the last day, the noble silence, is over. Tomorrow morning when you wake up, if you wish to, you can say, good morning. You can say, hi, thanks for being in my cottage and looking after me. So tomorrow you can make those connections. You find those connections are already there. There's a trust you built up with one another. And that trust is beautiful. You've got to know one another, even though you haven't talked together. You sat opposite each other in the lunch tables. And even that much, you'd be surprised how there's a bond has been forged. And that is beautiful. It just shows you there's many ways we can relate to each other. And sometimes it's beautiful silence. You can kind of feel each other and look at each other and help one another. And that's a beautiful bond which you make. Dear Ajahn, Thank you so much for being inclusive and invite the teddy bears and our inner child to the meditation hall. This is a marvelous attitude. You notice all the teddy bears here. They're very happy. They don't speak to you. But you have a bond with them if you've been cuddling one of them. You don't need to speech, you know, to have bonds and kindness. That's why they're here. And I was wondering just why these teddy bears, that they don't eat, or do they eat? Usually the day after a meditation retreat, because this is the forest, the teddy bears have a picnic. And all the teddy bears are invited. It's a Jhana Groves teddy bears picnic. Dear Ajahn, in your book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, you mentioned yo-yo jhanas due to excitement. Can it happen due to other factors such as fear? Thank you so much. If it's like from fear, that's usually the jhana comes and goes and doesn't come back again, like a yo-yo goes up and down. It comes in and then it disappears quickly and comes back again, disappears quickly. That's usually the excitement does that. If it's fear, you're close, maybe you might be able to go in, but it comes out straight away and never goes back again for days. Okay, that's my theory. Dear Ajahn, can does one get many first jhanas before second jhanas, etc.? Check it out. The one jhana is enough. Come on. How many people was I? I've already said this before. When you get something, you want something more. Isn't one jhana enough for you? So sometimes that's questions like that. You've got to get a first jhana before you get a second jhana. So sometimes, why this, you can go very deep very quickly, and you can get these really deep jhanas quickly. Sometimes you need to have many first jhanas, first of all. I was just thinking of an example. That guy I mentioned, you know, who did go to hospital because he was in deep meditation. He didn't need to, but his just wife freaked out because he wasn't breathing. Not breathing, that's usually a sign of third or fourth jhana. So he just went in really quickly. First time just going into a deep jhana. So it can happen, you just go, don't even get a first jhana. You have to go through the first jhana, but just go even deeper into second, third, or maybe fourth. Can happen. But anyway, I think one jhana would do, wouldn't it? You still have time, you know. Dear Ajahn, as a meditation process happens, my mind becomes quieter and stiller. It's harder to keep in mind any complete complex instructions. What simple instruction for the mind would you recommend? Let go. Thank you so much for your kindness, jokes and wisdom. I feel lucky to have been here. That's a good question. Keep it simple. Actually, even let go, or maybe just let it be. That might be even more powerful. Let go has a little bit of negativity towards it. Letting be is this wonderful opening the door of your heart, whatever's happening. It means you don't do anything. Venerable Ajahn, need to thank Noria, Christina, Pat for the loving kindness extended in all directions, especially looking after the sick yogi and all the other yogis with mega metta. May they be well and happy and attain the highest bliss of Nibbana. I agree. Do you agree? It's amazing you call them yogis. Now you know why these bears are here. Yogi bears. That's logical, isn't it? Does anyone remember Yogi Bear? They're still going on. That was when I was a kid, using it in Jellystone National Park. Not Yellowstone, but named after Yellowstone. So that's where they get Yogi Bear from. The bears who live in meditation centres. Venerable Ajahn, if one fully understands there is no one after deep meditation, letting go of all five senses, Why that person still wants to dress up, use cosmetics, nice clothing, etc., is because a person still has sensual desires. Please explain. No, if you get into deep meditation and you understand, really understand non-self, then basically you don't worry what other people think of you. So you can dress up if you need to, because sometimes, you know, that's what people expect of you. You just put it on, but don't really bother about it. But, you know, you're not really, the desire for it will go. You don't need to dress up. Look at me. Do I dress up? I dress down, see? I don't dress up, I dress down. Venerable Ajahn, is the world the same as the doer mind? Yes. I explained that already. I gave a whole talk about the doer. That is the will. And there's quite a few questions to go, and there's only 2 minutes left. You are the best teacher that I have ever met in my life. Wow, you haven't been around at all, have you? Now, there we go, not accepting praise. Bad monk. Thank you very much. My last questions. Are we allowed to share our meditation experiences with our family and friends? That's a very good question, because if it's a good meditation, only share it with someone who can understand it. Because if they don't understand it, sometimes, and you share it around too much, there's things like jealousy, and sometimes there's negativity. They say, you got good meditation? You've achieved a jhana? No way! What that does, you know, it creates some ill will towards people. These jhanas I mentioned are huge. And if you were a Christian and you had a jhana, they would name a church or a school after you. That's how big it would be. St. Vicky's School for Children in Indonesia. She's not moving. St. Vicky's, would you like that? No, she's resisting. She's breaking. She's about to laugh. Okay. Or St. Robin's. St. Robin's Hospital. In Perth. Would you like a hospital named after you, Robin? Usually you're dead by the time they name hospitals after you, because there's no choice in it. But they're really big. So only share experiences in meditation. Now, with your teacher, with people you trust, fellow meditators, yes. But not just with every part of the family. If it's like your partner in life, your husband, wife, yes. They should be able to understand what you've been up to. Can I use mindfulness bliss beyond book as my teacher after I go home? Of course. Not sure yet whether I can go home. I would love... They're just smiling. I would love to do more about jhana. I would like to thank all the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, for spreading their loving kindness to us all. Further, thank you, Nornia, Christina Pat, and all other organisers and volunteers who provided excellent care. Also, thank you for all kind-hearted people who provided us with excellent meals. Then I have to sort of stop for a little while. All those people who came to feed you, did they get any money from this? Did they get paid for bringing you food? They came here, some of them, you know, taking a day off work. Some of them are elderly, but they've got other things to do in their life. And they still came here to feed you all. It wasn't ordinary food, was it? Delicious food. They tried their very best to make nice food for you. Why did they do that? Because there's this care, kindness, making merit in the most best way possible. Sometimes they come here on retreat and other people feed them. It's a beautiful tradition. And that means, you know, everything is like given for free. And that just, you bliss out on that. As I said, because I sit and stare at this floor when I talk to you, and they're done by monks. And so much hard work was done in this place, not for any money. Our people being kind. They continue every day, they feed you. They feed the nuns. He gives these wonderful blessings. It's celebrating everybody's gift to create this retreat centre and make it actually work. It's impressive. Good. Dear AB, you mentioned this morning you were sceptical about the power of chance years ago. Can you share a story about someone who was sceptical of nimittas and jhanas? You can't really be sceptical until you experience them. I know there's many people who say that, you know, that jhanas aren't necessary. That makes no sense to me. Because if you are deeply insightful and still, the jhanas are there. There's no obstacle to them. And so I can't figure out why anyone would not just want to make that one step and get into the jhanas, really sort of have the beautiful pleasure, the Sambodhi Sukha, as the Buddha called it, enlightenment happiness, and understand what enlightenment actually is, how it feels. You may have all the theories about enlightenment, and you may have all of the information from this text and that text and this version of the text and the Sanskrit versions and the Chinese and the Dhammagupta and the, all the different types of Buddhism. You may have all of those ideas. But how does that stand against someone's actually experiencing it? And you can have that. Experience of what enlightenment feels like. You're not enlightened, but you have a taste of it. Why the heck not? So to me, just people who think it's not necessary, they're sceptical of it, just makes absolutely no sense. So the story of someone who actually was sceptical of these things, you know, I don't want to give people, give names, but after a while when they start to experience it, they realise that was wrong. Hi Ajahn, can you please share some more ways of overcoming unmonkish thoughts which are overpowering the last for several days? You're leaving it to a bit late, aren't you? If you really want to, this is what, there was one of these monks having unmonkish thoughts. So he went to see Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah gave him this amazing advice, so powerful. So if you have unmonkish thoughts, sensual thoughts, here's the microphone. Come and let everybody know what they are. Can you do that? It would work. It doesn't matter how late it is, everyone will stay and listen. But no, you don't need to do that. In the end, it's just, the poor old mind just gets a bit tired sometimes. So the best way of overcoming the unmonkish thoughts or sensual thoughts or thoughts of anger is for you to welcome them. Say, thank you for coming to visit me. And really do it honestly. They're teaching you something. It's not exactly the teacher you expected, but they teach you a lot. And you know, that story I said was just, wow, it's like gobsmacking. I never expected that would happen at all. Had unmonkish thoughts, and the only way I overcame those was welcome them. As soon as I welcomed them, they disappeared straight away. It was just the mind felt it needed to shout out so loud so I, you know, wouldn't ignore them. And then when I recognised them and I recognised what was really going on, I was not being kind to my mind. Once I was kind to my own mind, it's an obvious thing to do. Once I was kind, you can think whatever you want, mind. If that's what you want to think, fine by me. Then the mind never wanted to think those. All it wanted was some kindness, some respect, instead of always trying to train it and make it to be what I thought it should be. Do you understand that? It's very powerful. What do I think are the most important qualities of a good leader? What about a good teacher? I don't know. How would I know? I keep talking, and sometimes I tell terrible jokes and old stories, trying to get rid of you so I can go to bed. I'm tired. It doesn't work, does it? I'm still here teaching. Probably 10 years, I'll be still telling the story of Nalagiri tracing down the road. I'll be still telling the story of laying two bad bricks. Another 10 years' time. Will you still be coming?
Oh, no.
I know that I must be a very bad teacher. Honestly, it's obvious. You know why? The reason I'm not a very good teacher is some of you have been coming here for years. Same people, same stories. If I was a university teacher and no one graduated, they kept on coming year after year after, they would sack me. Does that make sense? So why do you keep coming? Because it's like learning how to sort of connect, share, inspire. Coming to a retreat is not like coming to university. You're not learning facts. You're learning skills. You're not learning knowledge you can get from books. And people write great books. But here there's something else which you gain, you gather. Someone else is peaceful and you can get that peace from them. You feel that peace. It's a wonderful thing to do. Sometimes I notice, I say, why do you go to these big concerts? You know, like, I don't know, who is the Taylor Swift? You can hear, I think, whatever she sings on YouTube, can't you? I don't know, I'm just making this up. But nevertheless, why do people pay thousands of dollars to go and see her live? And it's in the back somewhere. And something else happens with a live performance. You can read the book and all the information is in there and it's much more convenient. When you want to go to the toilet, just put down the book and go. Many of you just dying to go to the toilet, but you think that might be rude. Aren't books more convenient? No, there's something else which, you know, comes when there's a teacher and student relationship. What is that thing which comes across, which you don't get from books, you don't get from YouTube? That's one of the reasons why I'm a Theravada monk, and sometimes we criticize other traditions. But where did the idea of transmission come from? Being in the presence of a teacher, and there's something also goes across, not just the words. Anyway, next question. Is it all predestined? Some scriptures say it is. It's such a confusing concept. Yes, you were destined to write this. Were you? Of course not. Nothing is predestined, except that you will die. Is that predestined? Maybe you might be the first person in history who doesn't die. There always has to be a first, an anomaly. Sorry? Yeah. An anomaly. You want to be rebellious? Would you like, if I gave you immortality, would you take it? You'd be a dummy to take immortality. They have, you know, many... There was some movie, I think it was called Groundhog Day. And actually somebody... It was actually the guy who, you know, found Dhammasara, Ron Battersby. He said, that's a very good Buddhist movie. Ajahn Brahm, you should look at that one. It's not entertainment, it's Buddhism. And so I took his word. When I was on a Singapore Airlines flight, it was actually playing. So I looked at it. It's a good premise. He kept getting reborn every day. And he could actually mend all his mistakes so he could live a perfect day. Then he'd always get reborn in the morning and have to live the day over and over and over and over and over again. And it drives him crazy. He tried to commit suicide. Many times he killed himself and then woke up in the morning again. That's really frustrating. People don't understand the pain and suffering of life. You can make life perfect, but it's still not satisfying. That was a very good move in that way. But the ending, I thought, really was just spoilt the whole movie. You know how it ended? It's Hollywood, okay. He fell in love. When he fell in love, then he woke up the following morning and the spell was broken. Oh, that's dumb. Sorry. But anyway, how is one to follow your meditation instructions without turning into a kind of doing? Many thanks for a lovely retreat. Because if it's a kind of doing, you won't make progress. So you find the less you do, the more progress you make. Once I have heard a recording of a talk by Ajahn Mahabua in which he describes his own practice, hopefully in English or in Thai. Because sometimes when people translate, sometimes it's not exactly what he said. He said the first time he experienced a deep state of meditation, he experienced bliss and intense happiness, happier than anything one can experience in the world. But he said that after that happiness subsided, he experienced suffering, more intense than any suffering in the world, or any ordinary person can imagine. And it took him a long time of diligent practice, and until basically using his mantra Buddha throughout the day until he could reach the high states of samadhi again. Does everybody who experiences sayajana have to go through such a phase of deep suffering afterwards? No. They don't. Sometimes when you want, the more you want, the more you're making suffering for yourself. That's what the Buddha said. The cause of suffering is craving, even wanting good things. So when you learn how to let go, you get jhanas, and they don't come up again for a while. Fine. You had a nice jhana, that's good enough. Isn't it? So after a while, you understand the cause of jhanas, letting go of wanting. Dear Ajahn Brahm, much, much gratitude for all the kind, full enlightenment and profound Dharma teachings and guidance. Wishing Ajahn an awesome year ahead, good health and long life, and a happy birthday for 7th of August. Also, a heartfelt thank you for Noria, Christina, Pat, Patricia for their support as always, and for all the retreat participants, a delightful and joyful retreat with much metta and humbleness. Very good. You know, even though we've heard that quite a few times, I really value that, because gratitude is a beautiful thing in this world. Sometimes it's easy to criticize and find fault, but it's beautiful to say thank you to all the people in this room. And I'd also say thank you in particular to all those people who didn't write a question. You're very kind. Dear Ajahn, I get confused between caring for the meditation object and letting it go. It feels like caring is an act of doing. Oh no, it's not doing. Opening the door of your heart, no matter what that object is, no matter what it does, the unconditional opening the door of your heart. It's not doing anything, it's just purifying your heart so you can be kind. Doing is grabbing Nilagiri by the trunk and throwing him over the Ganges. Letting go is to say, Nilagiri, the door of my heart's open to you, whatever you do to me, fine. When I let go without the kindness, it feels calm and no joy arising. Any advice? Just, you don't have to have joy arising yet. Just let it go. Oh, let go without kindness. No, if you let it go with kindness, it actually really gets calm and the joy arises. So just keep on going, letting go with the kindness. Open the door. The kindness is the unconditional part of letting go. It is a saying, the door of my heart is open, no matter what you are, no matter what you do. To think that the Buddha could have stopped Nalagiri just with mindfulness, without the kindness, it doesn't work. Shout out to everybody involved in running this retreat so smoothly. The level of care and attention by Ajahn and organizers is phenomenal. Thank you so much. I need to, 3 questions to go. Close. Shall we do it tomorrow? Dear Ajahn, I'm crazy about this married man. Every time I see him... Every time I see him, my mind goes about a bit mad. And I know I should not act upon my desires. What's the best way of putting out this fire about, apart from running away or avoiding him and smelling his shit? I always have this feeling I've known him my previous life. Could this be true? Very, very unlikely. Of all the men in this world, there's millions of men. How many millions of men in this world? And you think that's the one for you? So, when you see him the next time, see if you can, if you could, great to ask his wife, what's he really like? Get the truth about him. And as soon as you find out, you think, oh, I'm very lucky, I'm not the one he chose to marry. Sometimes, though, when you are infatuated, you see all the good things in that person. When I was a young monk in Thailand, we were taught by our teachers, you don't have to worry about the tigers in the jungle. They don't kill many monks. What does the killing of most of the monks in Thailand? You said it. It was only the fact that, you know, you were a monk, you were young when you ordained, and some of these Thai girls were very pretty. And they would come into the monasteries. And some of these Thai ladies would come into them. You were a human being, you were a man. And you'd see them and think, oh, that's a nice one. And I didn't want, I mentioned this, I always wanted to become a monk. I loved being a monk. One thing I think I haven't said here was when I first was ordained as a novice monk, a samanera, the first 3 days I had nightmares. Woke up in the middle of the night in this room in the monastery in Bangkok. And my nightmare, the same every evening, my nightmare was that I was a layperson. I'm honest with you here. When I opened my eyes and saw my robes, brown robes, folded neatly next to my bed, my mattress on the floor, I really am a monk. And I closed my eyes and continued a very nice deep sleep. And 3 nights in a row that happened. And I kind of thought that was convincing me this is what I really wanted to do in life. So I never really wanted to do anything else, but so what did I do? To make sure that no lust came up. What I did was I would look at that girl and look for her pimple. I'm being honest with you, they always had a pimple somewhere. They weren't perfect. I knew I wasn't perfect. Now, when I was young, as a kid, I fell over and broke a tooth. So one of my teeth in front there was discolored. I didn't have enough money to go and see a dentist. So I had this discolored teeth and I was quite happy to keep it. When people in Thailand said, oh, we can fix that for you, I said, no, I want to keep it like this. That was my defense against tigers. Honest. But anyway, I could see some faults in people. And that actually takes away a lot of the lust and desires. It's always the then what. Whenever I had a fantasy, I'd try and fast forward it. Yeah, I win $1 million in the lottery. I develop psychic powers, so I can see the lottery numbers, and then win $10 million. I won't have to work. Then I can go and get my tooth fixed, and I can find a very beautiful lady, get a nice house, won't have to work ever again. And then what? Then what? Then what? I never believed about like Prince Charming and Cinderella or whatever it was. Then they met each other and they rode off happily ever after. Happily ever after. Have you ever seen that happen? Honestly, happily ever after. There's always problems and troubles. So when I did the fast forward of any fantasy or any dream, you realize it's not going to work. The real life, what I knew, is there'll always be problems. Two really good people. They're trying their best to care for one another. But they're two different people. Sometimes different wants and misunderstandings. And there are problems in married life. I saw that so many times with my mother and father. They would argue. They would make up afterwards. And they'd feel sorry that they argued, but that's what they do. It's a struggle. Anyway, the next question, it fits. Why celibacy? Is it necessary for jhana? Any tips how to stay celibate? It's very helpful for jhanas. I said this story to someone earlier in the interviews. The Buddha gave a simile of the sticks. There are three sticks. One was in the water, very wet, and you try to light a fire with it. It won't take because it's too damp. The second stick is outside of the water by the side of the road, side of the stream. It's still too close to the stream. It's damp. It's got sap inside of it. It still won't burn very easily. But the third stick is a long way away from the river. It's dried out, no sap left. That easily makes a flame. And that's the Buddha's simile. He said, when you have renounced, you don't have much stuff, much worries, no lust, you've given that up for quite a while, it's much easier to get jhanas. But it's not impossible. I have actually kind of warned you about this, that because it's my own experience, you know, just a young man, you know, having a nice girlfriend, sexually active. But then I went on my first retreat and got a very deep meditation. And the bliss of that was much better than sex. Please excuse me for saying that, but it's important to be like honest and straightforward. And basically that was the end of that relationship. I felt a bit sorry afterwards. So if you do have a deep relationship, sometimes that can happen. I'm warning you, but it's beautiful having a nice meditation. Anyway, earlier on in this retreat I had an interesting experience. I was sitting on a trunk watching the landscape when two kangaroos came hopping by and grazed not far in front of me. I watched them, and when I was changing my sitting position, they noticed me and looked at me. But the weird thing was that I could clearly feel one of the kangaroos having intense kind feelings or thoughts towards me, something I've never experienced with animals before. It is weird because the kangaroo certainly does not know me. Could it just have resonated on the caring attention I gave them in the first place? Quite likely. And it often happens that if you do that here in Jhana Grove, or in Bodhinyana Monastery especially, all the kangaroos there, they know they're very, very safe. And they sit there and they look up and they know it's a monk or it's maybe one of you. They sit up, look up, and then they just carry on grazing. They don't care that you're watching them. Or sometimes they're in the middle of the path and you have to push them off the path. Look, you know, I haven't got no shoes on, I need the path, I might step on something. So they think they own the place. Perhaps they do. Perhaps I should get off the path. Sometimes I do. But anyway, that, you know, we share this land with them, and they've known us for such a long time. Have you seen those kangaroos over in Bodhinyana Monastery with the white marks on top of their heads, their foreheads? That was the mother or the grandmother of most of those. She died quite a few years ago. She was one of the early kangaroos in this monastery, which, you know, we got to know when we first came here. And when we had a big bushfire many years ago, there was nothing to eat. They destroyed all of the grass and all of the leaves. So we got some pony cubes for them. That was apparently quite good for them. And we had buckets of those, and we would feed them every day. And we looked after them when there was no food for them because of a bushfire. I don't think they've ever forgotten that. They know that the human beings here, if there's any trouble, we will look after them. But we don't try and sort of domesticate them at all. They're wild kangaroos, and they need that their usual traditions to be able to flourish. And that's why they never bother us. I just remember my predecessor, Ajahn Jakro, saying that he was sitting in one of those huts right next to, you know, the cave. And he was just sitting there just in the afternoon, just watching the trees grow. And there was this male kangaroo who was running after one of the females. That's what they do at that time of year. And then a female was really panting. She was really getting tired. The male was running after her. So the female ran into where Ajahn Jakro was sitting and sat next to him, patting. He was very smart and stayed there for maybe about 15 minutes to get her breath back. Maybe that's a bit long, 5 minutes, 10 minutes to get her breath back. And once she got her breath back, then she jumped off and let the male kangaroo follow her again and jump after her again. You know, she was an ordinary kangaroo. That's what they do to mate. She didn't mind being mated, but she just wanted a bit of a break and a bit of a get her breath back. And the animals are just nice like that. They're not afraid of us. But how long have we been here? About 40 years now, I think, over in in Bodhinyana Monastery. So those kangaroos know us. Trouble is, when we go on retreat, you take your food back in a bowl and you put the bowl, you've got to be careful, if you put the bowl on the veranda for 5 minutes and you go inside to get something, that when you go back you find there's a kangaroo's got his muzzle in your bowl eating your lunch. That's happened quite a few times. And sometimes, you know, we shouldn't really just give the kangaroos some of the food, but we give them some anyway. And sometimes they know you're on retreat, and they come to your window if you haven't come out yet, and they put their nose and they knock on the window. Come on, I'm out here, it's time for my food. They're really cute and sweet. So that's... But I remember just also once we had excess food left over from the kitchen. And we put, you know, some good food out there for them, some apples, some carrots, some healthy food. I remember looking at this kangaroo. He found that big mound of food and he pushed aside the apple with his muzzle, pushed aside the carrots, and then he got the piece of food he really loved. Or she loved, it was a female kangaroo. He picked it up with her paws, a slice of pizza. They love the pizza. I don't know if it's good for their health, but just don't argue with them. They like it. It's a treat for them. And it's wonderful to actually to see the kangaroo just with its paw eating pizza. It must be the only kangaroos in Australia who can get a pizza. Why not? Okay. Thank you for enjoying my silly stories and jokes. Thank you sincerely for all of the praise you gave each other, and thank you as well for being great retreatants. And I wish you all happiness and peace and nimittas and jhanas. If they don't come tonight, they will come tomorrow. If they don't come tomorrow, they're on the way. So the mail has been posted, you just have to wait for a little bit longer before it arrives. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent.